Hi, I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Really great to be here tonight. I want to thank my friend Tim for asking me to come out. And you know what? It's the great meeting here. I've never been to this meeting. What's really interesting, as you'll hear in my story, I'm in Los Angeles now, but up until April of last year, I lived only about a half mile from here. So I was here in Laguna Niguel, right across from the YMCA. And I've been down in Orange County here for 20 years. So I just moved up to Los Angeles, but we'll get to that later. And I did want to comment on what a great meeting you guys have here. One of our great members historically, who has now passed on to the great meeting in the sky, Clancy. I used to talk about pockets of enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's a person who flew all over the world and speaking at conferences and around the country and been to probably more meetings than anyone else. And he used to talk about that, how there are places where we take a lot for granted here in Southern California that we have all these great meetings, but it's not true everywhere. So you guys, I'm really grateful and happy that such a great meeting is here. And as Tim knows, we have another Clancy also used to say, there's three things you need for a good speaker meeting. You need good structure, good speakers, and good coffee. So if you have those things, then you have a good meeting, right? Now, I haven't tried the coffee, but everything else is good. At least Koa was so far. But so when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told that there were three things I should get. And if I got those three things and kept them, I would be able to stay sober indefinitely. And one of those is a sobriety date. And I do have a sobriety date. It's April 8th, 2003. So 22 years this year. Thank you. Thank you. It's a personal best, so thanks. And the second one is a sponsor, and I have a sponsor. A lot of people here know him. His name is Jim Willard. He's very well known in Orange County. He's sober 53 years now. He's been around a long time since 1971. And a home group, right now, my home group is the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. And up until I moved up to Los Angeles, one of my home groups was the Laguna Canyon Club Saturday Night Speaker Meeting down here that I went to for many years. So I'm super familiar with Orange County and love seeing you guys. And so, with those three things, I've been able to stay sober now for 22 years. But as we'll get to, this is not my first long-term period of sobriety. So we'll get to that in a little bit. I grew up in Chicago and Southside Chicago. And my father was actually an iron worker. So he's a Chicago iron worker, had a really extensive criminal history when he was younger. And my mother came from the Catskill Mountains in New York, so they couldn't have been any different, right? She came from this little town, and my dad was this hardcore South Side tough guy. And but they were really nice people. And you know what? Neither one of them were alcoholics. And I bring that up because some people do have alcoholic parents, and sometimes that seems to be perhaps the cause of the alcoholism, but I didn't have alcoholic parents, and I'm an alcoholic, and my brother is as well. So, what I've discovered here in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I try not to assign blame for my alcoholism. And that's an important thing because then I'm being a victim if I'm blaming anyone. I may not be, whatever the cause of alcoholism, however we developed it. Whether it's genetic, there's a genetic basis, or as I believe, it's a genetic predisposition combined with environmental circumstances. I may not be responsible for having the disease of alcoholism, but once I know I'm an alcoholic, I'm responsible for my own recovery. That's one of the important reasons Alcoholics Anonymous works. It's because it's something we have to do ourselves. No one can do it for us. I think we've all tried a lot of the, things and more about alcoholism. Here are some of the methods we've tried. Yeah, I've tried a lot of those, as you'll see. So my first drink, I'm not sure about the first time I drank alcohol. It was probably at like a religious gathering, like a little sip of wine or something. But I do remember my first drunk, and I was 13 years old. Now, at that age, I think everyone here has, done their first time getting high or drinking, getting drunk. And you remember, you don't really know what's going to happen, right? It's like something, it's exciting. You read about alcohol, you read about drugs, it seems interesting. You want to try it. And so I was excited, and this kid said he was going to bring some liquor from his parents' cabinet. And what he did is he came to this dance. And at every school, and I know people here know this, at every school, there's a place people go to do bad things. You guys know this, right? Like a stairway or behind the stair, stands or something. And here it was like a recessed stairway. So you could go down this recessed stairway and kind of peek out. And he pulled a jar out of his parka. It's Chicago, it's called. He pulls this jar out and a paper bag, and out of the paper bag, he pulls out a jar. So interestingly, my first drink was out of a paper bag. And my last one was as well, as you'll see later. But what he had done is what a lot of us do at that age, right? He went to the parents' liquor cabinet and he took a little bit of liquor out of various bottles. Now, at this age, no one's been to bartending school. So he took a little bit, and in this jar where, it's this weird color, and it's like equal parts of like whiskey and peppermint schnapps and creme de menthe and whatever, right? And so he passed it around, and we, he drank some, he passed it to me, and I drank some. It's like we hear here, it burned, and I was like, oh, and it went around again. And there were four guys, and it came around again. It's like a big quart jar, and I did feel that kind of burning sensation. Now, at that time, I was 13 years old. I was a smart kid, but I was very shy. Now, you girls, you terrified me, right? I was super shy. And I went back in that dance and I was like, hey, baby, what sign are you? And because I knew you chicks intuitively dug that kind of thing, right? And and I was dancing with the girls, and I was talking, and I was the life of the party. And I was on the way home. I was lying in the street in front of cars, and they're beeping their horns. I remember it like it's yesterday. I went into the house, and I got sick, and I was lying on the floor in the room, spinning around. And my mom yelled down the hallway, "Well, he'll never do that again." And here I am, right, in an AA meeting. Now, parents, though, they think it's cute, right? They don't know that they weren't alcoholics. They don't know I'm going to become an alcoholic. And I didn't know I was an alcoholic either. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about alcoholism for a long time. But what I do know is that what the effect that the alcohol had on me. And in the doctor's opinion in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is one of my favorite chapters, and it's really, to me, it's the best description of the disease of alcoholism, along with the chapter More About Alcoholism that Bill Wilson wrote, that it has ever existed up to this point, which is interesting because those were written in 1938 and 1939. So he says in there, alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can once again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I got that sense of ease and comfort right away. And I chased that sense of ease and comfort for a long time, way past when it was reasonable. But that sense of, but I had to have it. We talk about the obsession of the mind coupled with the allergy of the body here. There's something that occurs in an alcoholic. And what I didn't realize, whether it was at that moment or sometime later, I did become an alcoholic. And the book tells us too, it says at some point we cross a line. It also says we don't know why the alcoholic reacts differently than other men. We cannot answer the riddle. And that was true in 1939 when that book was published, and it's still true today. We still don't have a full description or definition of alcoholism and addiction and why we're different than other people. But what we do have here is this wonderful solution. And what he says further, in the doctor's opinion, is that alcoholics like primarily because they alcoholics drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I was like, yeah, I do. But it's what I didn't realize until a long time later, until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, is that the effect produced on an alcoholic by alcohol is different than the effect produced on a non-alcoholic by alcohol. And it's different. There's something that occurs. The doctor tells us this again. He says they cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This craving differentiates them as a class from normal drinkers. So I have that. I had that. I had it quickly. And I went on really quickly to get in trouble as a teenager. Do we have any shoplifters here? Yeah. All right. I love you guys. Shoplifters, burglars, drug sales, everything, right? In high school. So by the time I was 17 years old, I was expelled from high school. Interestingly, for breaking into the high school, seems kind of ironic, right? And got charged with multiple felonies as an adult at 17. Barely escaped prison at 17. I went into a state-run rehab, instead of prison for 18 months. And I was in inpatient treatment for 18 months when I was 19. So I did stay sober for about 3.5 years. Got out, joined a band, played in a band for a while. They went on tour. I went to prison. But anyway, and so when I got out of prison, I did do a short term when I was 22 of 18 months in Illinois. When I was released, and the book also tells us this, it says that early in our drinking careers in particular, we can sometimes control our drinking. I'm paraphrasing to some extent, but I think we're all familiar with that, right? Alcoholism is progressive. It gets worse over time. So I was able, with that very severe consequence, to come get out and go to college. And I went to college in Chicago, and I went to a good school. And I eventually ended up with a computer science degree. And so a computer science degree was a good degree to have. It still is right now. And I went on to get good jobs and lost good jobs. And first thing I did is I bought a brand new V8 Camaro, five-speed, loaded, black. And, and of course I smashed it up a little bit later. Does anyone here relate to this fact that the car we drive tracks the trajectory of our alcoholism? Right? So we do, right? It's like a nice car, and I can't keep nice things when I'm drinking or using. So whether I smash it up, whether I sell it, things get lost, get stolen, whatever. So I ended up coming into AA, and as I'd mentioned before, this is not my first long-term sobriety. I actually took 8.5 years at one time. So I took 8.5 years and made a decision to drink again. How did that happen? Well, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 33 years old, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Chicago. I walked to an AA meeting. I was about to lose my job. I was drinking vodka out of a plastic bottle. I was doing cocaine whenever I could. I was a couple months behind in my rent. Everything I owned of value was in the pawn shop. And I walked into that meeting and I was shaking so bad I couldn't even hold a cup of coffee. They took me to a detox. They knew exactly how to treat an alcoholic of my variety. They took me to a detox and I got sober and I stayed sober. And I was just willing at that moment to do whatever was suggested to stay sober. And I did. And things got good really quickly. Like a lot of us, when we're doing well, when we're sober, I can be very successful. So I did get a sponsor. I had a sponsor. I worked through all 12 steps to the best of my ability. And I had the spiritual awakening that's promised in step 12. Step 12 tells us, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I really did that, right? Now, not as much service work as I do now, but I was involved. I was going to a lot of meetings and I was doing really good. And I started doing really good in successfully too in the world. I was got some really good jobs, a software engineer. I was making a lot of money. I bought a couple of buildings in Chicago. I got a real estate license. I was doing real estate on the side. And I ended up with some IBM certifications where it was a kind of a specialty, and I was flying around the country for a couple of years and doing really well. But near the end of that time, I started sort of, losing track of my Alcoholics Anonymous program. And at 7 years, I found, when about 6 years or so, I found a company that I wanted to move to California. It was my dream. And I found a company that would pay to move me to Los Angeles, which is what I wanted. I moved to Los Angeles. And the book tells us, and it's one of my favorite sequences in the book. It's in the section where they talk about step 10. It says that it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I had forgotten that, right? It also tells us, it says that we alcoholics are, and this is in a chapter more about alcoholism, it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. And that doesn't matter if I have 8 days or 8 years. So I was in out here, I was about a year out in California, and I bought a place in Venice. Does anyone know Venice? Yeah.
Yep.
Venice is a bad place to relapse. I don't know if there's a good place to relapse, but Venice may be a particularly bad one. So I'm in Venice and I bought a duplex in the Abbot Kinney neighborhood, which is really nice. So I had a great place. I had a when I was that 17-year-old kid getting in trouble in my room back in Chicago, I had a poster of a Porsche on the wall, and that car was in the driveway now. So I had this beautiful house. I play guitar. I had these rare guitars. I had these signed Salvador Dali prints. I mean, all this really nice stuff. But remember what the doctor's opinion says. It says they are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can once again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And the next sentence is important. Drinks they see others taking with impunity. And I was at that point where I was doing that. I was going to a fine restaurant or a sports bar, and I was watching people drink the imported beer. And I was like, I've never tried that one. Or the wine with a beautiful woman. I'm like, I don't think I've tried that wine either. But the book also tells us, it's very, very clear. No real alcoholic ever recovers control, regardless of what this mind tells me. So my mind, left to its own device, is always going to lead me to a place where there's some justification for a drink. So when I was sober 8.5 years, a little before that, I had a long series of discussions with my sponsor at the time, me. Right. So I had an idiot for a sponsor. And you know those little conversations, right? Hey, Jim, we've been sober a long time. You have so much self-knowledge, so much knowledge about alcoholism. Do you think we can pick up a drink again and drink like a gentleman? Sure, why not? Thanks, sponsor. This is what happens when we sponsor ourselves, right? So I didn't have a sponsor, and I was right there where the book talks about it. And I'm gonna kind of focus on something that I said in the, in that previous statement where it talks about our daily reprieve. What's interesting there, and sometimes we miss it, says, for alcohol is a subtle foe. Now, what is a subtle foe? What does that mean? It means an indirect or sneaky methods of trying to achieve something. And that's what happens. My alcoholism didn't come up to me and say immediate, Jim, go take a drink. It was more like, you deserve a drink. Your real problem is cocaine. And that's really what I believed. And I had convinced myself that as long as I don't do drugs, I'd be okay with alcohol. However, what I discovered is that when I drink, I find myself shopping for crack pipes. And that's what happened. I went to the corner in Venice and I asked for some. I started drinking. I walked to a liquor store on Lincoln Boulevard in Venice on a beautiful June night in 2001. And beautiful night just like this. And that liquor store is still there. It's north of Venice Boulevard on Lincoln Boulevard. And I walked in there and I bought a six pack of Heineken, 8.5 years sober. And I remember, and I had the cold Heineken under my arm, looking up at the moon. And I remember thinking, maybe I should call somebody. And my sponsor said, no, don't worry about it. We got this. And so I went into the house and I opened up a Heineken and I drank a Heineken and it tasted good. And I drank another Heineken and they lied to me that the sky didn't fall in. I didn't end up in the Los Angeles County Jail or smoking crack in Inglewood, at least that night. But all those things were going to happen. And quickly too, it wasn't long because when I drink, the book tells us very clearly, as I said, there's lost the ability to control our drinking, phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving differentiates us. Whatever the mind tells me, once I activate the alcoholism, it's almost like a switch. It's on. I'm on. I just go until the wheels falls off. And I did. Soon I was went to buy some cocaine and they threw these little rocks in my hand and I said, no, I want powder. And they said, take it or leave it. And I said, I'll take it. So, that's crack, of course. I started smoking crack. I had some money at the time. I had a house. And it's a dangerous place to be. And I basically went until everything was gone. And because of my criminal past, which had been 20 years before, I hadn't committed any crimes. It was like 20 years. Soon after I ran out of money, which was pretty quick, because what I discovered is liquor, drugs, and girls are expensive. So just the way it is, keeping it real. And so the money was gone very quickly. And I started stealing again. I started doing shoplifting schemes and burglaries. And I was, trying to sell drugs, trying. And really everything was gone really quick. And the house went into foreclosure and the car was went into repossession. And I ended up with a case, caught some, theft cases, and one was a felony. And I was in and out of the Los Angeles County Jail in 2002. And I ended up, when the house, what's interesting is that the house was sold the day before the foreclosure auction. So it kind of worked out for me as an alcoholic. But after paying all the debts and everything, I walked away with $50,000 in cash. And my sponsor and I decided it was a good idea to move into a hotel on Century Boulevard in Inglewood and sell crack. So, anyway, I won't leave you guys in suspense. It turned out to be a bad idea. Right? Because it turns out that I am my best customer and sometimes only customer, right? I had not been a successful drug dealer in high school or in my 20s, and I wasn't at that time. So things got bad really quick, and that money was all gone really quick too, within a few months. I ended up doing 6 months in the Los Angeles County Jail. And when I was released, it was January 10th. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. And when I was arrested, it was warm. So all I had were sandals and a t-shirt and shorts. And they're not giving out sweaters at the Los Angeles County Jail. So I was out on the street 4 o'clock in the morning, cold with nowhere to go. Everything was gone. I didn't even have an ID, believe it or not. Everything was gone. No bank accounts, nothing. And you never could have told me that would happen so quickly. And so in April, just before coming into the program in April, I was sleeping in a broken down pickup truck on 101st and Hawthorne in Inglewood. And you never could have told me that would happen. When I picked up that Heineken at 8.5 years sober in that beautiful house in Venice, you never could have told me. Never that could happen. I would have told you a million ways that I would stop that result from occurring. But it didn't because I have no control. But I was fortunate. I was a fortunate one. I was at that moment, and I believe for all of us here, and I believe what happened to me, Koa brought it up in his wonderful talk tonight. There's a moment where what I call a window of opportunity. Call it a spiritual epiphany. And there is a moment where, and I believe what that is a connection with our higher power, where we're willing, open-minded, and honest enough to receive the message that recovery is a better path. And that happened to me one night lying in that pickup truck, and I called the Claire Foundation in Santa Monica that I had been associated with in drug court. And I called them and they said, "Well, we don't have a bed for you, but come in." And I went in there on Monday and I slept on the couch for a couple of days and went into the program. And I'm fortunate there are places like the Claire Foundation. I didn't have insurance or anything at the time. They were able to take an alcoholic like me. It's a nonprofit and it's a wonderful program. And I was able to go in there and I was able to stay. But initially, I remember after I was sober, like my second day, maybe 2 or 3 days. And I think most of us here realize one of the reasons we drink and use is that we can blot out the misery of our current existence, right? One thing about alcohol and drugs, I have to say, is they work, right? They do work, right? I mean, they come with some pesky side effects, like the destruction of all things worthwhile in life. But still, they have that immediate effect. They have that effect. That sense of ease and comfort comes at once. And it's amazing. The doctor's opinion tells us that this becomes paramount to all other interests, only for us, right? And it did for me as well. And so I was so, but afterward, we're sober a couple of days, a little bit of time. I think for me at least, my mind was clearing and I was able to see how badly I had messed up my life. And I was wondering, is this even worth it? Is this even worth it? I don't even have a car. I have no money. I have, probate. I mean, I had actually absconded. I didn't report to probation, so I had a warrant, a felony warrant. And I was asking myself, is this even worth it? And there was a guy in there who was like in the head of detox, right? You know how in your rehabs you have like the person who's there a few days and they get to order the new people around? So he was like that, and he got to order. He was telling everyone mop the floor or whatever. And so he asked me one time. He says, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Not good." I'm like, "Not good." And I had heard him talk and I'd heard him share, and he had a similar story to me. And I said, "Not good, man. I don't even know if this is worth it." And he says, and I, he says, "Well, how long are you sober?" I said, "3 days." And I said, "How long are you sober?" And I don't know if he was standing like with a light behind him or a window or something, but he had this long blonde hair and he said, 10 days. And I was like, oh, I mean, it was like, hallelujah. He was like a recovery prophet, 10 days sober. And I bring that up for a reason, because people who are new, whether you have 2 days or 10 days or 30 days or 2 years, sometimes we think that our experience is not important. But I remember that guy. That guy kept me sober another day. His example, 10 days was a lot to me at that moment. And so I never saw that guy again. I'm sure he doesn't remember me, but I remember him. So we never know what word of encouragement from us might help someone struggling. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a person with 3 days. It could be a person with 8.5 years. And I'm sure when I went out, and I do speak to the people who are new, especially welcome to you. And I speak also to anyone who maybe is struggling and is sober a while. Stick with us. I wish I had heard that. I'm sure I'd been to meetings and I'm sure someone said that, right? But I wasn't hearing it. And I hope you hear it if you're here. Stay with us, it's easier. It's just a wonderful program we have here, and we do it together. So I actually was able to stay sober. I got a sponsor. Eventually, I got a job. And this is kind of interesting. So it's kind of a story about how we're going to face challenges and temptations early in our recovery. And I think most of us know that who've been sober a while. Early on in recovery, you might turn around, like go to a family gathering or something, and you turn around and there's a drink. Hey, have a drink. You're like, oh, what, what do I do? And these things happen though, and they happen to us even if we're sober a while. Now, for me, I eventually got a job. I got some, I thought I had a great experience, and I was going to get a really good job right away. But there was a little problem. It was called a felony, right? So I wasn't getting that really good job right away in corporation. They would check my, they said, "You're great. We love you. You start Monday. By the way, fill out these background check forms. It's just a formality." I'm like, "No, it's not." So anyway, I was denied a bunch of employment, and I had to, this program I was in, I had to get a job within a certain period of time. So I ended up getting a job. Now, I would not necessarily recommend this, but I ended up getting a job on the same block I was living on in Inglewood. Funny story. So this guy on that block who ran a roofing company from his house, he had like a double lot, and he had his trucks come in the morning and supplies in the back. You know how sometimes people do this. And my friend, so I was so when I was sober about 5 months, my friend convinced the owner of this company that I had been a person involved in real estate, and I could work for them as a salesperson and go out try to get business for this roofing company. So and they were going to buy me a car, and they were going to give me money for clothes. And I had a sponsor at this time, and a good sponsor. And he told me, you know, in your situation. And what I had to do is go down there and report in the morning, and then go drive around all over LA to, you know, property management companies or real estate companies, and then come back in the evening. So I wasn't there all day. And he said, "This is a good job for you. I want you to go there. I want you to call me in the morning when you get there. And then when you get back there at night, I want you to call me." And I did. So I'm down there. I got the car. I'm wearing a nice suit because I was going to these property management companies. And, so I was working there maybe a month or so, and I had money in my pocket, and I was pulling out. It was in the morning, and I was going to get back into my car, and I hear, "Hey, Jim." And I turn around, there's this girl. And it was a girl I always liked. And she was like this heroin dealer's girlfriend, right? And she never would have anything to do with me because I didn't have, you know, enough of money. But she's like, "Hey, Jim." And she comes up to me, and she's like, "Hey, I hear you're clean." And I'm like, "Yeah, I am." And she says, "You're totally clean, really?" And I'm like, "Yeah, totally." And she says, "I mean, you wouldn't take a hit right now if I gave it to you?" And I'm like, "Whoa." And then she goes, "Oh, I wouldn't do that." And she pulls herself close to me, and I could feel the warmth from her body and smell her, you know, freshly showered. And so she says, and she pulls herself close to me, and she says, "Unless you wanted it." And I'm like, my mind's like, "I want it." So, but you know what? I heard a voice say, "You know what? It was nice seeing you. I have to go." And I walked back, and I got back in my crappy little newcomer car with a resentment and a hard on. Just keeping it real, sober peeps. But you know what? I stayed sober that day. Interesting, right? I could never have passed that up. I could, everything I associated with drugs and alcohol was right there. I could hit the Ramada Inn with a rock from where I was. I had $100 in my pocket. Beautiful girl standing there with drugs, liquor store across the street. Everything was right there, and I walked away from it. Our book talks about us having no mental defense against the first drink when we're not in fit spiritual condition. Now, did I have a mental defense at that moment? Yes, you bet I did, right? I had a higher power. I was working the steps with the sponsor. I was in communication with the sponsor. I had a commitment at a meeting, a chip commitment. And I had that mental defense. I was able to walk away from that. And so you may get some sort of temptations like that early on, or even after a while. See, alcohol is a subtle foe. Alcohol can gets us when we're down, or gives us opportunity to have exactly what we want. Now, being in fit spiritual conditions means I can make that decision and avoid that drink, but it's only on a daily basis. What we really have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So I went on to move down to Orange County, eventually got a good job here. I got my really wonderful sponsor, got really involved. I started getting into H&I really quickly. And I will bring this up for anyone who's struggling too, because we don't always bounce back that quickly. I got a job because they didn't do a background check. I guess it was like a consulting company, and they placed me in a corporation, so they should have done the background check for this other company, but they didn't, right? So I had a job for like a year, but after that, again, the background check issues came up, and I was without a job, and I was sober almost over 2 years, and I didn't even know how I was going to pay my rent the next month. And I asked my sponsor, I said, "What do I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. What do I do?" And he said, "Just keep doing what you're doing." And I did, and I redoubled my efforts. I joined HNI. I got multiple panels, and I told myself, if I have to sleep in my car, I'm going to stay sober. I don't care if I'm, sober 2 years on. And interestingly, what happened is that things started to pick up at that time for me. And eventually today I have my own business, digital marketing, doing really well. I do lots of service work, and I got involved down at the Midnight Mission through Clancy back in 2009. I've had a commitment there since 2015, or 2009. Since 2009, I've been doing HNI out in the prison since about 2015. I have a panel out at Norco, and I get to go out there and see the consequences of alcoholism, and I need to see that. Because no matter what's going on in my life, I think I have issues, and I go to the prison, and I, there's guys in there, and or at the Midnight Mission, and I see the potential consequences of alcoholism, not just for them, but for me. There's no guarantee that I'm going to stay sober forever. In fact, I don't say I'm going to stay sober forever. I can't. But I will stay sober today. Coming out here sharing with you guys. I will stay sober today. If I do the things tomorrow that I've been doing, I'll probably stay sober tomorrow as well. But I want to leave you guys with that idea, a couple things. One is this, what's really important, what I really try to reiterate to myself on a regular basis is what we say in, we read in the Alcoholic, it's in the Alcoholics Anonymous preamble. And it says that our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And that's interesting, right? Because our primary purpose, it's not our primary purpose just when we're in a meeting. To me, I read that, that's my primary purpose in life. My primary purpose, that has to be the central part of my being, is this staying sober and helping other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And if I do that, good things tend to happen for me. And I have to ask myself, and I do on a regular basis, I say, is my primary purpose to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety? And are my actions consistent with that stated primary purpose? And sometimes I have to, change something, but usually they are. And it's really a wonderful thing to have that purpose. Because what I realize and what comes along with that is that we often hear about these concepts of like purpose-driven life. And we will always have a purpose here if we grasp that. No matter what's happening, if you're about to sleep in your car and you're still sober, you still have a purpose, and it's a beautiful one. And I'll leave you guys with this other story. And it's actually one that Clancy used to talk about. Now, as we're familiar here, some history of Alcoholics Anonymous, we had two co-founders. We had Dr. Bob Smith and we had Bill Wilson, right? So Bill Wilson's sobriety date was December 10th, 1934. And Dr. Bob's sobriety date is the birth date of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in his, June 5th, 1935. It's in his story in the big book. And Dr. Bob died in 1950, and he gave his last talk at the 1950 International Alcoholics Anonymous Convention. Now, Clancy talks about this in some of his talks, and you can find that. You can actually find the actual talk itself on YouTube or on some of the speaker tapes. And you can type in Dr. Bob's last talk or 1950 International Alcoholics Anonymous Convention. And in it, it's very short because he was dying. His body was racked by cancer, and he went up to the stage, and this was his last talk, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Clancy calls it the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what is the Gettysburg Address, though? Why is it so famous? Because it's short and meaningful and eloquent. And this is only 3 minutes long, but the main part I want to leave you guys with is this. He says that our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We know what love is, and we know what service is. So let's bear these two simple things in mind. And so I'm going to keep trying to do that as best I can. And I think that we can have a tendency to complicate Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But we are really a program based on spiritual principles. And according to the co-founder, those principles themselves really simmer down to the essence of two, love and service. And it's really a beautiful thing if we can recognize that. Now, do I practice love and service all day, every day? No. I don't think any of us do, right? But again, I try to reiterate those things to myself. And that's really the key to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there's any secret, and there is no secret, it's consistency. It's really consistency, doing the same things day after day. We talk about this being a simple program, and it really is. So I'm going to try to maintain that primary purpose I talked about, and I'm going to try to implement these principles of love and service. And by doing so, I've had a wonderful life, and I hope you guys do the same. Thank you.